and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams, broadcasting to you from Cambridgeshire in the UK. It's September now, and we're heading into our autumn season, and we thought we'd better start with a bang, or preferably not with a bang at all. But we're going to talk about nuclear power. It's been time to press the big red button on this subject for some time now. We've been trying to get some people on to talk about it. So we're very pleased to have two guests for this episode. We have Amelia Hipwell, who is Decarbonisation Innovation Manager at the Lloyd's Register Maritime Decarbonisation Hub, and Shirayu Batra, an independent expert on advanced reactors and small modular reactors. As I say, Amelia is the Decarbonisation Innovation Manager at LR Maritime Decarbonisation Hub. She manages the hub's proprietary Zero Carbon Fuel Monitor website, which provides an insights-based assessment of the readiness of zero carbon fuels for maritime applications and industry-wide comparisons of alternative solutions across the fuel supply chain. Amelia joined LR in 2016 after graduating with a master's degree in engineering from the University of Durham in the UK. She's recently authored two published reports for the monitor, for the LR monitor. That's first one is called Zero Carbon Fuel Monitor from October last year, and How Close is the Shipping Industry to Adopting nuclear for Propulsion? She's also worked with the Sustainable Shipping Initiative on their report, Green Steel and Shipping. Shirayu Batra comes to us with over a decade of experience in advanced nuclear technology. Currently, he's channeling his expertise into what he calls a new stealth mode venture focused on advancing nuclear technology. Most recently, he was Chief Technology Officer at TerraPraxis and Lucid Catalyst, two nuclear power industry companies. He's also worked on large-scale deployment strategies for nuclear energy and worked as a project officer for advanced nuclear reactor technologies at the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. He has an in-depth knowledge of nuclear reactor design, safety, and technological development. He has a double master's degree in nuclear engineering and nuclear reactor physics, along with an undergraduate degree in materials science. So we have a great pair here matched in expertise on the particular aspects of looking at nuclear power for shipping. On the one hand, we've got the technological experience and expertise, and on the other, we've got the commercial application of that. So let's go and hear what Shirayu and Amelia have to tell us. Amelia and Shirayu, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much for having us.
Perhaps you could just take a minute to introduce yourselves for the benefit of any listeners who may not be acquainted with you. Amelia, please go first.
I'm Amelia Hipwell, and I work in LR's Maritime Decarbonisation Hub, where we've got the mission of accelerating shipping safe, sustainable and human-centric decarbonisation. I work in the role of Decarbonisation Innovation Manager. So I've been looking mostly at our zero carbon fuel monitor tool, which is a tool we use to assess the readiness of zero carbon or near zero carbon fuels across the supply chain for shipping. And through these assessments, we aim to identify where we as a hub, but also as a wider industry, can focus our efforts to make sure that we're having the most impact on that path to decarbonisation. And of course, our most recent data refresh was the nuclear technologies part, which we had the pleasure of working with Shirayu on.
Which is a great segue into Shirayu. Thanks. Shirayu, yeah, how about you? Please let us know where you're from.
Sure, thanks. So my name is Shirayu Batra. I'm a nuclear engineer and a reactor physicist, and I've spent almost a decade now on advanced reactors. The bulk of my career has been in the International Atomic Energy Agency, where I worked as a nuclear engineer for some years and then moved to a role of project officer for small modular reactors. I have published and spoken extensively on specifically on advanced reactors and small modular reactors. I have worked with design, safety, feasibility studies with several countries also while I was working at the IAEA. Beyond IAEA, I worked in a strategy consulting firm and a nonprofit organization where I was working on projects like repowering coal, where we're trying to find out ways of repowering the coal infrastructure with nuclear, and where I also got to work with the Lloyd's Register on finding nuclear as a solution for maritime industry. Currently, I'm working independently in a stealth mode startup, so I'm working on some new ideas in the space of nuclear, and hopefully they will be revealed by the time this podcast is out as well.
Brilliant, thanks. Well, we look forward to that announcement, but in the meantime, thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast. let's start with the big picture. You know, nuclear is a very technical subject, but let's try and start with the big picture. You know, between the two of you, what do you think is the estimated time frame for nuclear powered commercial ships to actually appear? I mean, I know there have been three atomic powered ships in the past, one launched by Japan, one by the US, one by Germany, and none of them were really commercially viable. They all got converted or scrapped. This time around, is there any difference? Amelia, are we looking at 10 years, 50 years, never?
Yeah, that's right. There have been a few instances of nuclear propulsion on commercial ships previously. As you say, these couldn't operate profitably because of the complex and expensive technologies at the time. But now, from a technology readiness perspective, there's already a well-established nuclear industry on land for pressurized water reactors. And shipping would also be building on a very well-established supply chain for uranium as well. And there are new and more suitable technologies in development and being deployed elsewhere in other sectors that shipping can benefit from. So the technology itself isn't likely to be the biggest obstacle. Rather, it will be the negative public perception around safety of nuclear, safety and security, and also the current lack of standards and regulations for onboard adoption. And developing these standards will take quite a lot of time. So in the meantime, I expect we'll see national regulations and approvals on a case-by-case basis. So I anticipate that first movers could be appearing as soon as the early 2030s, but it'll be likely at least a decade until we see nuclear propulsion coming in at volume and being commercially viable.
Chiray, do you back that? Are we at the point in history where this is technically viable? How safe are nuclear reactors now to put on board ships?
Yeah, and I think to understand that, and also maybe a little bit on to add color to what Amelia said, if you look at the history of commercial nuclear-powered merchant ships, there have been four so far which have commercially operated. Maybe they were not necessarily designed for commercial operation, but they were used commercially as well. One was the NS Savan in US, which was built in late 1950s, but came into operation in 1960s. There was one in Japan, came operational in 1970s, called as Mutsu. The one in Germany, called as Otohan, came operational in 1970s as well. And there's the Russian one, Severmut, which is currently operational as well. And what we see in the terms of deployment timeline for all of them is that they took at least a decade from the point they started to build to the time they were floating in the water. What I feel is that journey, the technical journey to understand how to put a nuclear reactor on a vessel, I think that has been covered by the history. So in terms of making a technology viable to operate on a reactor vessel, that exists today in terms of light water reactors, Amelia said. But what's happening now is that those reactors were mainly, and if you talk also about the submarines and all these subsurface vessels, which are non-civil operations, they're also very compact. Now, with the advent of small modular reactors, what is happening now is that the designers are making considered design choices to make them very compact, while also following the regulations of using low-enriched uranium or something called as high SA low-enriched uranium, which is the enrichment up to the level of less than 20%. So within those regulatory constraints, the reactor vendor designers are operating, are making those kind of designs. Now, in terms of safety, if we look at the operations of the four merchant ships that have been operated so far, all of them have operated safely. I think the Japanese Mutsu did almost 82,000 kilometers, which is like two circles of the earth, without any issues. The Germany's Otohan did, I think, within the first 4 years of operation, almost 500,000 kilometer operations. And it used, just to give you a figure of merit, only 22 kilograms of uranium and operated safely all through these 4 years. Whereas if you take that into comparison with the liquid fuel that could be used, it will be order of thousands of gallons. So it just brought in a lot of advantage, not only from the operational perspective, but looking at the safety history, it has been historically very safe operation for those. Looking ahead, I think the Generation 4 reactors, they have an inherent philosophy of making them more safer. They are already working to make them safe by design. So they have this principle of 3S by design, with safety, security, and safeguard by design. So when we will move away from light water reactors to this advanced generation 4 reactors, I think safety becomes a key concept of the design itself. And the consideration that will be remaining will be the integration issues of how these Generation 4 reactors or advanced reactors get integrated with the ships and the vessels. And those are the safety considerations which I think the classification societies like LR will be looking into it and will be probably trying to make some regulations around it.
So if we think these fourth generation reactors are safe, how about the challenge of using them in maritime applications? What do we need to do? You've mentioned, you know, the role of the class societies there. Amelia, can you elaborate a bit on that for us? How do the class societies work with shipyards, ship owners, naval architects, and so on to make sure this technology is safe for the lifetime of a ship, which could be, you know, 25, 30 years?
There are already regulations and standards in place for the handling, production, the life cycle of the nuclear fuels. And the nuclear industry is already highly regulated across the supply chain. But regulations and standards obviously need to be developed and adopted in shipping as well. So they'll ensure that not only will the reactors that come onto the market will be safe, but everything will be in place for safe operation. So really, this is like any new technology being introduced onto the market. It will follow the same type of process to make sure that it's safe. In addition, nuclear technologies also need to comply with the IAEA regulations, which are very stringent requirements for security.
Yeah, security is an issue, isn't it? Shipping already faces issues of piracy, and we've seen recent attacks on commercial vessels in the Red Sea. I mean, how do we make nuclear-powered vessels safe? The ships that used to carry nuclear waste on behalf of BNFL in the UK had armor on them, they had cannon on them to prevent anyone trying to attack them. You know, if we're going to have regular cargo vessels operating with nuclear power, what happens if they get, you know, attacked and sunk? What happens if somebody tries to pirate them?
If you want, Amelia, I can take the physics answer first, and then you can go ahead with the regulation. So I think this is a very important question, Mark, and this, I think, needs like also some bit of understanding to also build up the public perception around. It's a very valid question that how we can make it like secure and safe. One thing that I briefly mentioned was that most of the designs are working on like this 3S by design, which is security by design and safeguard by design. This reactor, which could be in the category of like micro reactors of the order of 10 to 30 megawatts electric, what they're also targeting is a long-term operation. So that means once you fuel it, you don't have to fuel it for decades or maybe for 10 or 20 years. What it allows is that this reactor can then be like sealed just after fueling and cannot be opened for next 10 to 20 years. So that brings like some inherent security measures and safeguard measures that come into picture. The second thing that we need to understand, again, from the physics perspective is like, once you take the reactor, now what's going to happen after that? The thing is like, if you're a pirate and you take the reactor and you open it, that's going to lead you to death. So that means the first outcome that's going to happen is people dying on it. Doesn't matter, you bring more people, the more people are going to die on that. So the deaths are going to happen because of the radioactivity. So the thing is that the fuel will be so hot at that point when you, let's say, capture it and try to open it, it just becomes inherently safe from the security perspective. That means like inherently secured as well. Now, how and what you can do, let's say, after a long-term storage of it, so you can keep it for several years. Now, what happens is the same as it happens in the large light water reactor as well. The fuel, which is also accounted by IAEA safeguards mechanism, so it goes through a very strong accounting measures. In case of normal operations, yeah, this will go through the accounting process as well. In case of some kind of sabotage, the material that's going to come out will depend a lot on the type of reactor that was used in the reactor as well. And for several of these reactors, the nuclear material that's going to come out of the reactor is not going to be weapon-grade material. So you can have the material, but the weapons cannot be made out of that fuel that's in the reactor. So that also brings a sense of proliferation resistance to several of these designs. And a lot of the designs are actually already working on proliferation-resistant features. So that means even if you get access to the spent fuel, it cannot be used for weapon material. Of course, it's radioactive, so yeah, you can throw it on a couple of people and that's it. But beyond that, from the perspective of physics, it's not very useful weapon material that you would like to acquire. There might be some other better ways that could be done to acquire that kind.
What about the aspect of being in ports? I've been told one of the issues with nuclear powered vessels is it's not so much to do with the ship; it's to do with where the ships go. When a ship calls in a port, there's usually a large urban population nearby, and there's a sort of public safety and insurance issue about what happens if there's an accident. You end up irradiating a large port city. How do the latest reactor technologies protect people from those kind of radiation leaks?
So just to give you some more historical context for the German Otto Hahn, I think it visited 33 ports in 22 countries. So that has happened before as well. There will be like regulatory aspect, which probably Amelia would have a better answer to, like how the port authority will deal with it and how the ports will get ready to have a nuclear powered vessel coming on shore. But I think several ports are all probably they receive nuclear submarines on the port sometimes, and they are probably accustomed to how to manage that. But there will be a need to set up a commercial setup for that. Now, coming from the perspective just of the technology, a lot of advanced reactors or this generation 4 reactors, they are working on a philosophy of almost no offside release or limiting the offside release to the boundary of the reactor. So that means, first of all, they're trying to prevent the accidents to a very, and making the probability for the accident very low, of the order of like 10 raised to the minus 6 or 10 raised to the minus 7. So a severe accident could happen once in a million year or even more. And let's say in case of that rare event also, when it happens, the offside releases of the radioactive material would be limited to the plant boundary itself. So that means the potential extent to which it can damage the natural habitat or the local population is out of the question here, because the only thing that needs to be protected is the people who are on board. And I understand there is a risk to people who will be on board, but beyond that, people who are on the board or who are on the port or beyond that, I think the risks are almost minimized to a very low extent or just practically eliminated through the process.
So the risks are insurably low, we might say.
Yeah, insurance is probably another topic, which probably we have to understand in more detail, that how this whole asset, which will become quite capital intensive and quite expensive compared to the current vessels, because when you will bring a whole reactor and which is also fueled for 20 years, this all becomes a very expensive asset. You can assume an order of magnitude added to the current cost of the vessel. And in that case, the insurance, how that can be done, I think it's a different challenge for the industry.
On that point, Amelia, have you got a view on what the challenges are for making nuclear-powered ships financially viable? You know, I've seen estimates that the cost of the ship goes up to something like $250 million, but the operating costs fall so fast that over the lifetime of the ship, you're paying out about the same as operating a fuel oil.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's probably worth noting that, as with most fuel options, nuclear propulsion won't be the most appropriate choice for all ship types, such as smaller vessels, but it will be particularly well suited to larger and more efficient cargo ships, for example. Although, as you say, these would require large upfront cost for the installation of a reactor. But we see that this is something that, rather than this being a cost necessarily being put onto the ship owner, it's likely that in the future new business models could emerge where the ship owner doesn't actually own the reactor, but could be paying for the power generated from the reactors, rather than owning them and operating them themselves. Exactly, yeah. And this type of agreement would also separate the ship owner from the complexities of licensing and operating the reactors. So once an agreement's in place, that there obviously won't be the challenges around bunkering and future fuel availability and costs. So overall lifetimes should be lower than other zero carbon fuel options, and comparable to fossil fuels.
On that comparison, how does the nuclear power propel the vessel? Is it a direct drive to electricity and electricity turns the propeller shaft, or does it generate steam for steam turbines? How does it work these days?
Yeah, I think like for any nuclear power producing engine, this will be also producing mostly electricity. And I think the direction is also towards the electric drive. Most of the designs are equipped with the power conversion system, which is Rankine cycle of steam generators. So yeah, you produce steam and then steam can be used to produce electricity. Some of the advanced designs are also using Brayton cycle for the sake of efficiency and because they're able to reach higher temperatures as well. This will also lead to, eventually electricity production and driving through the direct drive as well.
I want to come back to that point about scale. Earlier, you mentioned sort of 10 to 30 megawatts as a typical output range. And Amelia, you said these would be more appropriate for the largest ships. The biggest 24,000 TEU container ships can have engines that generate 60 megawatts, but an awful lot of the global fleet actually only operates at about 4 to 10 megawatts. So is scale a challenge for these, or is that all under control?
I think from now, I take the hat of like reactor designer. From the perspective of like designing a compact reactor, I think it's a very challenging exercise. And given the limitations that might be on the vessel to put these reactors, I can imagine like probably some of the large vessels where the engine rooms are of the order of like size of a house. This might give like more space for the designer and more degrees of freedom for the designer to actually design something which can produce more power. But the problem with nuclear that could happen when you are designing the reactor is that how to keep it like compact and power dense while still maintaining the enrichment ratios below 20% or in some cases even below 10%. Because one of the things that Amelia mentioned about the fuel supply, this is a critical component in the whole nuclear industry. So the enrichment facilities are also limited, and the enrichment, when you increase the enrichment, the cost also increases. So some designers are trying to optimize for the enrichment cost. Some designers are trying to optimize for the space that you need or the power density of the reactor. In that sense, I feel that the reactors, small reactors, could be designed up to the range of around 150 megawatt thermal. And with, let's say, 40% energy efficiency, you come to the level of 60 megawatt electric, which you were mentioning, Mark. But going beyond to like very large vessels and very large power, I think that will need some smart engineering to be done in order to keep it compact. But if there is more space available and we can have higher power density reactors, for example, lead-cooled fast reactors or sodium-cooled fast reactors, I think we can also reach up to the power of 150 megawatts.
So we'd have some very fast vessels operating if we're utilizing that level of power.
I think that's the advantage that nuclear could bring. You can drive them faster. You can explore new routes. You can keep them operational for years without refueling. And that's what the advantage, I think, is something that shipping industry is actually looking at. And one of the things that is important to understand that beyond decarbonization, what benefits could nuclear bring in? And that's what I think is going to make a real commercial case. And when you talk about financing, the financing will also make sense when the nuclear can become competitive without any carbon pricing advantages or things like that. And that's where people are actually working on those kind of concepts.
Amelia, what's the Lloyd's Register view on this? If nuclear power ships become a reality, how's the shipping industry going to change? You know, if everyone's operating nuclear powered ships at 40 knots, we're not going to need very many ships compared to fuel oil ships traveling at 12 knots, are we?
Yeah, exactly. And it's nice to cover this point because I think quite often a lot of emphasis is put on the challenges when it comes to adopting new fuels. But in this case, it's also important to highlight these potential benefits. So it really does have the potential to disrupt and transform parts of the shipping industry. So as Shirayo said, obviously, with ships sailing at higher speeds, we could see completely new operational models. Fleet sizes could reduce. It could be kind of really high efficiencies. I think we'll see in the future ship owners exploring how they can benefit with their specific use cases and specific fleets. And of course, with the low refueling requirements and low maintenance requirements, again, there's efficiencies there. And another benefit could be that vessels could potentially be designed for much longer lifetimes, and other new models, commercial models could emerge. So for example, ships could even be providing power to shore whilst they're docked at ports. But I think this is something that as the industry matures, we'll start to find more and more potential opportunities that it could bring.
It's often the case with new technology that the use cases evolve as you produce and roll out the technology, and sometimes the use case isn't what people thought it was going to be for at all. You know, nobody thought that the internet was going to be all about kittens and TikTok when it was first invented. But and what about fleet by fleet analysis? Is this going to be most suitable for bulk carriers with iron ore on board, or oil tankers, if we are still going to have oil tankers in 50 years' time, or is it going to be container ships that are floating inventory?
Well, I think if we look at kind of size of vessels first, there'll be different. There'll be kind of a minimum size that it makes sense to operate a nuclear reactor on, and there'll be different reactors for different use cases. But in general, they will be applicable quite widely, and particularly on larger ships. I mentioned earlier, particularly larger cargo ships, which could benefit from the very infrequent refueling, etc.
Just to add to that, Mark, if you allow me a couple of minutes, is
yeah.
Based on also the previous work that I've done with LR, we have actually done some analysis on different types of vessels and their power requirements. And as you said before, they range from like 4 to 10 megawatt to 150 megawatt. And in terms of applicability, we have seen, at least for the container ship, there is a very good match that the current development that's happening in the power range and the requirement of the container ship, that matches very well. But I think for the bulk carriers as well, there's a big
going back into my own history, I remember writing a paper for LR back in 2010 about the opportunities for nuclear-powered very large container ships. Back then, we wondered if we might ever be able to achieve anything bigger than 15,000 TEU, and we're already at 24,000 TEU. So scale is something shipping has become very good at, I should say. So, well, listen, guys, it's coming to the end of our time, but I'm really grateful to you both for coming onto the podcast. It's been hugely informative for me. It's brought me quite up to date on a number of issues that I wasn't entirely clear on. So I hope that our audience has also found this to be beneficial. If people want to find out more about your work, what's the best thing to do? Amelia, I suppose LR has a pretty well-developed decarbonisation website.
That's right, yeah. So you can reach out to the Decarb Hub through our website, and you can find out a bit more information on the Zero Carbon Fuel Monitor page, where you can also download our latest report, which is the nuclear report from Zero Carbon Fuel Monitor.
That's something to look forward to. Thank you. And Shirayu, when are we going to hear about your new stealth project?
I'm expecting to have that revealed in a couple of months. Things are moving nicely. And till then, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if anybody wants to reach out, I'm very active on LinkedIn. But hopefully, yeah, in a couple of months, I'll be able to reveal my broader plans on nuclear enabling work.
Super. Thank you both. It's been really interesting for me. I'm very grateful to you and everyone out there. And listener land has enjoyed this one too. I think it's a great way to start our autumn season, our Q4 season of podcasts on ship energy. So thank you again. And thank you to everybody out there in listener land for tuning in again. And do stay tuned. There'll be another episode coming out in 2 weeks' time. But for now, it's Mark Williams from a sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK signing off, and speak to you very soon. Bye for now.